as I've told you many a time, against these jihadists.
Wonder what that was all about. Hey, Two Seekers, good evening. Malloy here on the Nova M Radio Network. Thanks very much for tuning in. Mensa Man took the microphone today at a press conference. So, yes, we have more on sounds for your listening pleasure. Again tonight, a little bit later into the program. And I thought he was going to provoke Martha Raddatz into just walking up on the podium and bitch-slapping him. That would have been great. Well, not for Martha, but, you know, for the rest of us. A couple of items here that slipped under the radar, so to speak. I just wanted to say, nice effort to the truckers. I mean, who rallied at Capitol Hill. There were about 300 truckers, I understand, that drove blasting their air horns around D.C. It was a good effort, guys. But 300 of you, how many truckers are there? 50,000? 100,000? It's almost like trying to get a rally to stop the war. Rather than drive around D.C. and clogging up the city streets, it's just absolutely got to piss off the residents. And then the whole issue is lost in a cloud of diesel fumes and angry residents trying to get someplace, or angry motorists, I should say. Why not this? Huh? Pull over. Stop. Stay there. Now, I realize that that's easy for me to say because I don't drive an over-the-road rig to earn a living. I understand that. So here's option two. There's nothing to do about it. There's no way to fight this. The oil companies released their first quarter profits today. What was it? $15 billion? So option one, pull over, stop, don't move. It's not going to work because truckers all are in the same boat as most of us. They've got to keep the paycheck coming in. So, option two, let's stop screwing around. It's time to just say, that's life, and keep going. And let the prices spiral up to cover the cost of the diesel fuel or gasoline, and end the story. This is not France. In France, the truckers pull over and stop. And nothing happens. Until their demands are met. This is not France. France does not have 300 million people. So anyway, no sarcasm here, no ugliness, just nice try, nice effort to the truckers who got involved in that. But it's like holding an anti-war rally and having nine people show up on the federal courthouse here in Atlanta. I understand. Trust me. Hillary Rodham Clinton has a solution to the high prices of gasoline. Suspend the federal is it excise tax for 3 months. Woo! What is that, about 18 cents a gallon? For 3 months. Nice, Hillary. That'll work out to maybe $100 per consumer, if that. And, of course, that's money on an individual basis. $100 is $100. Multiply that by all the drivers, all the motorists in the country, and you've just gutted the Highway Trust Fund. Nice move, Hillary. A lot of forethought there. Bush tosses the terminally panting and four legs up $600 rebate check, or a $500 or $1,000 or whatever the hell it is, $300. I don't even know, because I don't think we're going to get one, are we, Kathy? That's what Bush tosses out. And Hillary Clinton wants to toss pennies. And thank God Barack Obama looked at it like, what? What? Cut federal gas. And, of course, we'll get into this a little bit tonight. Bush says the gasoline shortage and all the problems with liquid energy in this country is all Congress's fault, and we need more oil wells drilled in protected areas like Anwar. Of course, he doesn't add that it'll take years for those wells to become productive to the point where they're actually pumping gasoline that is then refined into, or pumping oil that's then refined into gasoline. And what did I hear tonight? The estimate is by the year 2025, if we opened up the entire Alaskan National Wildlife Refuge, by 2025, it'll reduce the cost of gasoline by a penny a gallon. This man is a crazy son of a bitch who just, oh, he needs to be removed from office. But he's not going to be, because also we have for you, it looks like the invasion of Iran, at least an aerial assault, is on for the first week in May. And once that happens, of course, a declaration of something, martial law, suspend the Constitution, state of emergency. All the scary people who were whispering around and saying it on fringe talk shows about, well, there's not going to be an election in November of 08, and even there is, there's not going to be a transition. Maybe those scary people were absolutely right, huh? Who was it? NBC? NBC did a poll. 83% of us say we are in a recession. 83% of Americans say we are in a recession. 73% disapprove of the way this freak is operating, the freak being George W. Bush. I think we have some of that tonight, too. And, Brock's former preacher is totally off his nut. He's got his 15 minutes of fame, as pointed out today in the New York Times by my favorite columnist, second favorite, whose name I am forgetting right now. Who is it, Kathy? You mentioned him in your blog today. The columnist for the New York Times. Oh, God. Yeah, Herbert. That's right. Bob Herbert. Speaking of Iran, here it is. According to CBS News, the second American aircraft carrier is now in the Persian Gulf. That was the one that, CENTCOM, not CENTCOM, but the Pacific commander, admiral, who is going to be let go, did not want to have happen. Didn't want a second aircraft carrier. Now, why is there a second aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf? Well, along with that, the Pentagon has ordered military commanders to develop new options for attacking Iran. Now, the other night we talked about the Pentagon has ordered its top commanders to develop contingency plans. Now, the word contingency is gone. New options for attacking Iran. CBS News national security correspondent David Martin said that the planning is being driven by what is being called, quote, the increasingly hostile role, end quote, that Iran is playing in Iraq, like smuggling weapons into Iraq for use against American troops. You know the quickest way to stop that? Remove the American troops. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates says, quote, what the Iranians are doing is killing American servicemen and women inside Iraq, end quote. Secretary Gates, what we are doing is killing Iraqis inside Iraq. Hello? Oh, well. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Mike Mullen, has warned Iran not to assume the U.S. military can't strike. Or should that word be won't strike? Can't strike? Mullen said, quote, I have reserve capability, in particular our Navy and our Air Force, so it would be a mistake to think that we are out of combat capability, end quote. I have reserve capability. The U.S.? No. You have it. All right. Later this week, what's today, Tuesday? Well, that's within the next 3 days, I guess. Later this week, Prime Minister al-Maliki of Iraq is expected to confront the Iranians with evidence of their meddling and demand a halt. Well, Maliki doesn't want to do that. I mean, wasn't Ahmadinejad just over there? Weren't they drinking Coca-Colas together and talking about the light at the end of the tunnel or something? No, I guess not. According to CBS News, though, if that doesn't produce results, Maliki warning Ahmadinejad to stop everything, stop meddling. Stop meddling? Gates calls it killing. Meddling, killing, oh well. If that doesn't produce results, the State Department has begun drafting an ultimatum that would tell the Iranians to knock it off or else. Well, what is this? Are these high school people writing this? Knock it off, or else what? Just or else. The State Department is drafting an ultimatum telling the Iranians to knock it off. Come on now. So look for between May 1st and May 8th. I think somebody sent me an email a couple of months ago. It said May 1st, May 8th. That's when the attack will occur. And I probably wrote back something to the effect of, get back on your meds. To that person, I deeply apologize. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
There is a war between the left and right, a war between the black and white, a war between the heart and the evil. Why don't you come on back to this war? Why don't
speakers
and be on Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the fields that this ain't exactly real.
21 past the hour. It was Admiral William Fallon, the name I couldn't think of, who said no to the second aircraft carrier. Well, he didn't come right out and say to George Bush or to any of his bosses up the chain, no. He just made sure the second aircraft carrier did not make it to the Persian Gulf. It's there now. Regarding the 9/11 truth thing that we are going to focus on periodically, not going to focus on it a lot tonight. As a matter of fact, just a couple of things here I wanted to add. My chief correspondent on this has an idea, and I want to share it with you, because in certain quarters there's an awful lot of resistance to accepting what our eyes tell us, or what our hearts tell us. There's a hardened attitude that what the government says is exactly what happened, even in light of what this filthy, putrid government does. But let's move beyond that for just a second. My correspondent says maybe at the beginning we should accept at face value, just accept at face values, all those scenarios outlined in the websites that debunk everything, or from the federal government, and the findings of the 9/11 Commission about what happened that day. Let's stipulate from the beginning to try this little thought experiment here. Let's stipulate from the beginning. Okay, all that stuff is true. We're not going to challenge any of those findings. At the outset, he writes, let's assume that there is not one scintilla of relevant datum unearthed by the truth movement explaining what occurred on the day of September 11th. Let's say that the sheer volume of information gathered was compiled by well-meaning but misguided amateurs that had neither the time, access, nor money to mount a credible investigation into the events of 9/11. Let's say that. Let's also consider that from the presence of FEMA in Manhattan on September 10th, the war games overseen by Dick Cheney on September 11th, to all the anomalies, all the coincidences, all the eyewitnesses' accounts, it's all off the table. Everything. We're going to just clear it away for all the people who really just desperately need to accept the story as presented. Let's sweep it all away. We won't discuss physics, aerodynamics, metallurgy, or other related scientific data that pertain to the events of 9/11. Okay? Get it all off the table. We can leave that to the experts to battle it out amongst themselves. Refuting someone else's facts or defending one's own facts, you see, takes up a tremendous amount of time. So let's declare it all null and void. All of it. We're not going to talk about it. But there's one area of investigation that is loaded with verifiable, previously reported news items from print and broadcast media that show foreknowledge. Now, as my correspondent writes, that is the key that could unlock 9/11. If we analyze the actions, inactions, and statements of key figures in the Bush administration and other related so-called persons of interest, we see a pattern demonstrating that all of them had foreknowledge of 9/11. And after sifting through all the available advanced knowledge reports, we can come to two conclusions. Here they are, or one of two. One, rogue elements within this government were proactively involved in orchestrating the attacks of 9/11 in order to implement a calculated agenda. Or two, rogue elements within this government, through suppression or inaction, allowed the attacks of 9/11 to occur in order to implement a calculated agenda. In other words, it gets down to the made it happen or let it happen. But the bottom line is, either conclusion exposes a betrayal by this government of monstrous war criminal proportions. Now, again, there is enough solid evidence out there now. Presidential daily briefs, all sorts of meetings and discussions that show that this corrupt, filthy government had foreknowledge. And either they made it happen based on that knowledge, or they let it happen based on that knowledge, but there is no third conclusion. It's impossible. A murder committed to achieve a goal, or a murder allowed to take place to further an agenda, what sort of legal or moral measurements do we use to decide the difference when talking about this kind of evil? Now, as my correspondent writes, if we can prove as much as we can under the circumstances foreknowledge, then we can venture into the more challenging aspects of 9/11 and, if necessary, for clarification, refer back to what we've already established. But I didn't get that many emails, frankly, saying, oh, give it up, don't go there, oh, no, this is crazy. As a matter of fact, I have to say, and I mean this absolutely, about 99.9% of the emails I got were supportive of the idea of just throwing this open for discussion and see what happens. But I like the suggestion. Let's move it all off the table. Let's not argue about buildings collapsing. Let's start from the standpoint that this corrupt government knew that something was going to happen. The unbelievable, say we should accept the unacceptable, the pious and the hip, so hypocritical.
I understand that the unrest in the Middle East creates unrest throughout the region.
You do? It's about 25 before the hour. Now, tangentially, I want to bring this up too. The idea of such a thing, the U.S. government planning, or rogue elements within the government planning and or executing what occurred in this country on September 11th, absolutely has precedent. It was not executed, but of course, I think most of you know about Operation Northwoods. In the book Body of Secrets by James Banford, published by Doubleday back in, oddly enough, 2001, on page 82, and a couple of following pages, just a couple of things I've highlighted here. Lyman Lemnitzer, at the time, was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And as Bamford writes, in Lemnitzer's view, the country would be far better off if the generals could take over. For those military officers who were sitting on the fence, the Kennedy administration's botched Bay of Pigs invasion was the last straw. The Bay of Pigs fiasco broke the dike, said one report at the time. President Kennedy was pilloried by the super patriots as a no-win chief. The far right became a fount of proposals born of frustration and put forward in the name of anti-communism. Active duty commanders played host to anti-communist seminars on their bases and attended or addressed right-wing meetings elsewhere. Although no one in Congress could have known at the time, Lemnitzer and the Joint Chiefs had quietly slipped over the edge. According to secret and long-hidden documents obtained for Body of Secrets, the Joint Chiefs of Staff drew up and approved plans for what may be the most corrupt plan ever created by the U.S. government. Obviously, the editor was not familiar with what happened in September 2001. Back to what Bamford wrote. In the name of anti-communism, they proposed launching a secret and bloody war of terrorism against their own country in order to trick the American public into supporting an ill-conceived war that they intended to launch against Cuba. Codenamed Operation Northwoods, the plan, which had the written approval of the chairman and every member of the Joint Chiefs, called for innocent people to be shot on American streets, for boats carrying refugees fleeing Cuba to be sunk on the high seas, for a wave of violent terrorism to be launched in Washington, D.C., Miami, and elsewhere. People would be framed for bombings they did not commit. Planes would be hijacked. Using phony evidence, all of it would be blamed on Castro, thus giving Lemnitzer and his cabal the excuse, as well as the public and international backing they needed, to launch their war. The attempts to provoke the Cuban public to revolt seemed dead, and Castro, unfortunately, appeared to have no inclination to launch any attacks against Americans or their property. Lemnitzer and the other chiefs knew there was only one option left, and that would be to ensure that would ensure their war. They would have to trick the American public and world opinion into hating Cuba so much that they would not only go along, but would insist that he and his generals launch their war against Castro. A world opinion and the United Nations Forum said a secret Joint Chiefs document, quote, should be favorably affected by developing the international image of the Cuban government as rash and irresponsible and as an alarming and unpredictable threat to the peace of the Western Hemisphere, end quote. Continuing, Operation Northwoods called for a war in which many patriotic Americans and innocent Cubans would die senseless deaths, all to satisfy the egos of twisted generals back in Washington, safe in their taxpayer-financed homes and limousines. One idea seriously considered involved the launch of John Glenn, the first American to orbit the Earth. On February 20, 1962, Glenn was to lift off from Cape Canaveral, Florida, on his historic journey. The flight was to carry the banner of America's virtues of truth, freedom, and democracy into orbit high over the planet. But Lemnitzer and his chiefs had a different idea. They proposed to, I believe it was Admiral Lansdale, that should the rocket explode and kill John Glenn, quote, the objective is to provide irrevocable proof that the fault lies with the communists in Cuba, end quote. This would be accomplished, Lemnitzer continued, quote, by manufacturing various pieces of evidence which would prove electronic interference on the part of the Cubans, end quote. Thus, as NASA prepared to send the first American into space, the Joint Chiefs of Staff were preparing to use John Glenn's possible death as a pretext to launch a war. And then this. The suggested operations grew progressively more outrageous. Another called for an action similar to the infamous incident in February 1898 when an explosion aboard the battleship Maine in Havana Harbor killed 266 U.S. sailors. Although the exact cause of the explosion remained undetermined, it sparked the Spanish-American War with Cuba. Incited by the deadly blast, at the time more than 1 million men volunteered for duty. Lemnitzer and his generals came up with a similar plan. Quote, we could blow up a U.S. ship in Guantanamo Bay and blame Cuba, end quote. Quote, casualty lists in U.S. newspapers would cause a helpful wave of national indignation, end quote. There seemed to be no limit to their fanaticism. Quote, we could develop a communist Cuban terror campaign in the Miami area, in other Florida cities, and even in Washington. The terror campaign could be pointed at Cuban refugees seeking haven in the United States. We could sink a boatload of Cubans en route to Florida. We could foster attempts on lives of Cuban refugees in the U.S., even to the extent of wounding in instances to be widely publicized. Now, this goes on and on. If you want to read it yourself, I think most of you are familiar with Operation Northwoods. But if you're not, just do a Google search, Northwoods. That's all, just Operation Northwoods. Or go to James Bamford's book, B-A-M-F-O-R-D, James Bamford, which is titled Body of Secrets. But Operation Northwoods occurred when a large number of people listening to this program were alive and doing their thing in the U.S. And the similarities between the plans for Operation Northwoods and the actual events of September 11, 2001 is just one more of those odd series of coincidences. That's all it is. Simply coincidence. Now, that's easy to understand, because madness in, the 12th century is probably very similar to madness in the 15th, which is similar to madness in the 20th, which is similar to madness in the 21st, when it is linked to out-of-control government power, whether that power is, the locus of that power is in the military or in the hands of neocons like Dick Cheney. But when you read the documents, and a couple of these websites have the actual documents signed off on by these joint chiefs, so you can just see it yourself rather than take the word of an author. But when you look at the documents, or don't, read what I just shared with you from Body of Secrets, obviously it's like reading fiction. That's fiction. It has to be. Any idea that the U.S. government under George W. Bush either actively or passively were involved or was involved in the events of 9/11 is fiction. Has to be. Has to be. Because if it's not fiction, then it's untenable. You can't hold it in your head. You can't do it. You cannot do it. Even now, with the distance of almost 50 years, 45 years, to think that the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the United States were planning on hijacking airplanes, flying them into buildings, setting off explosions, killing Americans, blowing stuff up, committing mass murder in order to invade Cuba is staggering. Now, Kennedy fired Lemnitzer because this idea was presented to Kennedy. Who knows what John Kennedy said when he saw it, but Lemnitzer was removed from office. Now, I'm not saying it was a firing. He was removed from office. He wound up as NATO Supreme Allied Commander, but he was gotten out of his role as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and nothing occurred. There was no Operation Northwoods that was brought to fruition that actually happened. But when you look at the plans from, 45 years ago, what these people had in mind, and yet someone wants to say, well, Malloy, the events of September 11, 2001 are exactly as proposed by the Bush crime family and the 9/11 Commission. Those are the facts. Anything to the contrary is madness, is insanity, and comes from the lips of jackasses like you, Malloy. Okay. But again, as my correspondent said, let's wipe it all off the table, everything, and we're left with two choices, aren't we? Either with all the foreknowledge, and I don't know if we have to establish the foreknowledge. Hasn't that already been established? Or has it not? Was there no PD, Presidential Daily Bulletin, that Condoleezza Rice and George Bush and the inner circle of these murderous sons of bitches went over, that came out in August, that said Bin Laden determined to strike in the U.S.? Did that not happen? Or did it? Did the CIA operative go to George Bush on his ranch and sit down and explain to him, and Bush respond, okay, you can go now, you've covered your ass? Did none of that happen?
Based on everything I've seen, I do not believe anyone could have prevented the horror of September the 11th.
Right out here for a What happened? And then this is all we're going to talk about it tonight. I guess you all know that there is a possibility of something for May 1st through the 8th when the Bush administration will be conducting nationwide terror exercises. Now, the last time something like this happened, oh, never mind. Where was this? It's written by Dr. James Fetzer and Major William Fox. They're both former Marine Corps officers. Captain Eric May and Sergeant First Class Donald Buswell are former members of Army Intelligence. And, damn, I'm going to piss someone off here for not giving the right credit. But anyway, they talk about, first of all, the American-flagged ship that took a shot at the Iranian Navy Swift boats the other day. And now the article says Pentagon sources say they have been ordered to prepare attack plans. Admiral Fallon, the CENTCOM commander who opposed war with Iran, has been ousted in favor of Bush loyalist General David Petraeus, who has spent the last month accusing Iran for increasing problems with the Iraqi resistance. It goes on and on and on. It says, in his much-discussed February article, False Flag Prospects 2008, Captain Eric May documented the disturbing fact that military and police exercises were occurring at the same time as the 9/11 U.S. attacks in 2001 and the July 7th U.K. bombings in 2005. In that article, he designated the Pacific Northwest as one of the top three target zones for the next U.S. false flag attack. And the Pacific Northwest will be the target of terror drills May 1st to the 8th. Should a major event occur during the drills, the Bush administration is prepared to implement National Security Presidential Directive 51, which establishes dictatorship, quote, in the event of a man-made or natural catastrophe, end quote. It is an extraordinary measure, and the White House has stonewalled Homeland Security Committee members from the House of Representatives who wanted to read it. One of those members, Oregon's Peter DeFazio, summed up the feeling of many Americans about NSPD 51 when he said, quote, maybe the people who think there's a conspiracy out there are right, end quote. Fears that a false flag attack might result in martial law are nourished by last week's militaristic Operation Sudden Impact, that describes or talks about three states subjected to martial law sweeps. On Thursday, May 1st, the exercise begins in Washington State when an explosion collapses the Alaska Way Viaduct in downtown Seattle. These are drills and damages surrounding buildings. 20 minutes later, terrorists explode a hijacked tanker ship filled with highly toxic chemicals at the Seattle Ferry Terminal. Deadly gas soon permeates downtown Seattle. Emergency responders come in waves. Police and firemen first to arrive are quickly overwhelmed. The state deploys its 22-member civil support team, a National Guard unit, yada yada. Later, 100 soldiers from a chemical battalion based in Yakima arrived to rescue, decontaminate, and treat survivors, blah, 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 blah. On Monday, May 5th, the scenario shifts to Oregon, where VX, the most toxic nerve gas ever synthesized, erupts from the Umatilla Army Depot. The next day, terrorists blow up a chemical tanker in Ferndale, Washington, blah, 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 blah. Nah, come on, nothing's going to happen. What's wrong with you people? What is wrong with you people? It is... You know, all this stuff is giving paranoia a bad name. Well, here's an old friend, Chris from Abiquiu, New Mexico. Hey, Chris.
Hey, man. How you doing?
I'm all right. I thought you died and went to Oregon.
Well, I thought you died and I couldn't find you again. You got to understand, I'm a guy who lives in the mountains of northern New Mexico. I don't do internet. I don't do credit cards. I don't want the government even that far into my life. So.
I hear you. Kind of off the grid, are you, Chris?
No, a little bit. As far as what you're talking about, I've always considered the Bush administration a man-made disaster.
That's yeah.
On a global scale. The thing is, I've always been a little bit less skeptical than you about how things are going to turn out. I think we're going to be okay.
Uh-huh.
coming up. I mean, given, you know, the elections, it does what you want to call them. You know what was funny today? Hillary Clinton was talking again about the Lincoln-Douglas debates.
Yeah.
How she wants to do one with Barack Obama. Of course, the person who's behind always wants to do lots of debates.
That's true.
Well, and she doesn't have any money. But Fox News...
Yeah.
Was discussing the Lincoln-Douglas debate.
I saw this. Yeah.
Yeah, they put up a picture of Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass.
That's right. Well, it's Fox News.
Well, yeah. Like, Frederick Douglass was running for the presidency in 1860 against Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, well, he was really the first black candidate, you see.
Well, yes. I mean, never mind Ms. Chisholm. This guy had it all up on her by a 100 years.
But this is Fox News. This is what they do constantly. You remember that report that came out a couple of years ago that said the vast majority, something like what, 75% of regular Fox viewers had everything wrong about the war, the invasion, the occupation, everything.
Well, yeah, but you also have to understand that at one point, I guess it was, what, 2.5 years ago, 67% of the American people actually believed that Iraq had something to do with 9/11.
That's true.
You know, I mean, such is the power of the press.
I hear you.
Going back to Iran, something that nobody seems to remember, and I do, because I'm old, the American Navy actually destroyed more than half the Iranian Navy during the Iran-Iraq War.
That's right.
Therefore, we were...
Hey, you want to hold on?
Yes, please.
All right, hold on. And we'll chat a little bit more when we come back from the break. I'm Mike Molloy. This is Nova M. The hour. Molloy here on the Nova M Radio Network. Right before the break, we were talking with Chris of Abiquiu, New Mexico, who used to be a very regular caller and sometimes substitute and had his own program out in Santa Fe, talk radio program. All right, where were we, Chris?
Well, right now we're in Santa Fe.
Is that where you are?
Well, no, I'm in Abiquiu, but I had my show, thanks to you and Kathy, in Santa Fe. It was a lot of fun. Haven't spoken to you since then, really.
No, it's been a long time.
Yeah. We were talking, you know, about Iran and history. What I really called about was, I don't understand why any Democrat would be afraid of John McCain. Okay, I mean, you could aside from Barack Obama's calling bitter wackos, and you know, Hillary has this Private Ryan moment in Bosnia. Fine. But we're talking about John McCain.
Right.
Do you understand the man owns 8 homes across this country, and he's already misplaced 2?
Yes, I've heard that.
Yeah, well, no. the guy is kind of foggy at lunchtime what he had at breakfast. And I'm not ageist. You and I are not spring chickens. Let's point that out. But
yeah, indeed.
We're talking about a man who was born before vinyl records. How bad is that? I mean, he's not going to live the next 15 years. Obviously, I'm an Obama supporter, but if Hillary gets the nomination, I'll vote for her. One or the other is going to be the president. and then they'll become the enemy of you and I, which is, you know, that's kind of a natural progression of things.
That's very true. That's
you have a true. Good night, my friend. All I'll right. email you.
All right, Chris. Thanks a lot. Take you care. Bye. Take care. Good guy. Chris in Abiquiu, New Mexico. The other day,
Santa Fe Sundown.
Santa Fe Sundown, was that his show? That was his show, yeah. Santa Fe
I
Sundown?
I miss Chris. I don't even think Chris knows we have a baby.
I love,
she's not a baby.
I love this headline. I'm sorry. I guess we should pause. And
I'm okay now.
Oh,
I
good.
I played Goodnight Moon Game with our little 3.5-year-old tonight, and I'm all verklempt over the mother-daughter reunion or something. Forgive me, I'm on antihistamines.
Yes, you are. You are really on antihistamines. Anyway, where was I? Oh, that's right. I'm doing a talk radio program. Ah, I remember now. I don't know where I got this either, but it comes from a very reliable source. One of the contractors that gets a lot of business in Iraq and is involved like Blackwater and Kellogg Brown & Root and Halliburton and the rest of them in stealing as much as they can get their hands on is DynCorp, DynCorp. I like this headline today. DynCorp manager used armor card to transport hookers in Iraq. Some explosive testimony this afternoon from a panel of whistleblowers testifying before the Senate's Democratic Policy Committee on Contractor Abuses in Iraq. A contractor died when a DynCorp manager used an employee's armored car to transport prostitutes, according to Barry Halley, a Worldwide Network Services employee working under a DynCorp subcontract. Here's the testimony. Quote, DynCorp's site manager was involved in bringing prostitutes into hotels operated by DynCorp. A co-worker related to the ring was killed when he was traveling in an unsecure car and shot performing a high-risk mission. I believe that my co-worker could have survived if he had been riding in an armored car. But at the time, the armored car that he would otherwise have been riding in was being used by the contractor's manager to transport prostitutes from Kuwait to Baghdad. Now, other revelations, Kellogg Brown & Root, contractors used to destroy countless quantities of still usable equipment that was difficult to transport in what was called massive burn pits that were, according to testimony, burning 24 hours a day. Kellogg Brown & Root's ICE foreman, quote, was cheating the troops out of ICE at the same time he was trading the ICE for DVDs, CDs, food, and other items at the Iraqi shops across the street, end quote. And when KBR whistleblower, Kellogg Brown & Root whistleblower Frank Cassaday, reported weapons looting, he was placed in a jail tent by KBR security. Okay, that's DynCorp. Now, there's this. This is from Washington Post yesterday. KBR employee, I guess this is testimony too. KBR employees working in Iraq. No, this is from the Houston Chronicle. KBR employees working in Iraq stole weapons, artwork, and even gold to make spurs for cowboy boots, two former company workers told Senate Democrats yesterday. Appearing before the Democrats-only panel looking into allegations of contract abuses in Iraq, the witnesses accused their former co-workers of widespread improper activity. And it goes on and on and on. So Kellogg Brown & Root and DynCorp. And then this, also from the Houston Chronicle. I love this. Houston-based Kellogg Brown & Root has again been selected to participate in a 10-year military logistical support contract valued at up to $150 billion, the U.S. Army announced today. The Army Sustainment Command, at the insistence of the Government Accountability Office, had re-evaluated its decision last summer to award the massive contract to Kellogg Brown & Root and Fort Worth-based DynCorp International. But after rebidding the contract, the Army chose the same three players. The third one is Fluor Intercontinental of Greenville, South Carolina. Jim Laurie, the Army Sustainment Command's Executive Director for Acquisition, said he had great confidence in the way the contract was awarded. He said, quote, it was a detailed process with an expert team that took a thorough look and a thorough review of all the proposals. So, transporting hookers, burning equipment, stealing gold, art, and weapons. In other words, committing acts that, if committed in this country, would send people to prison for a very long time, some of them, does not disqualify Kellogg Brown & Root, Cheney's company, or DynCorp, which is probably run by some private equity firm owned by Republicans. It does not disqualify them. This is goddamn madness. Do you know that? This is just insane. Insane. Army officials expect to launch the new program in about 60 days. Kellogg Brown & Root and DynCorp, without argument, it has to be stipulated in any discussion of these companies, first of all, they're war profiteers. In a different time and place, the executives of these countries would be taken out behind the nearest tent and kneeled down and shot. They are war profiteers. They are wallowing in the blood of dead American soldiers. They are wallowing in the blood of dead Iraqi civilians. They are stealing, looting, raping, and procuring prostitutes in a war zone. And what are we doing about it? Well, we get the information from this closed hearing. Let me rephrase it. What are the Democrats doing about it? The Democrats are getting ready to authorize another 180 or 200 billion to continue this madness. Now, will Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, as President of the United States, make it quit, make it stop? Will either of them do that? Will John McCain do it? I don't know. I do not have that good of a grasp on the English language to say how this affects me and affects you and affects the country. I don't have it. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. Fossil matter drilling, creeping while the children die. Cronyism spreading, come on, we'll bomb a wedding. Boy, you better naughty girl, you put your weapons down. I am the con man, they are the con men. Harder to understand it. Things are tough all over on Earth. It's hot in December, cold in July. When it rains, it
reality pours. Radio for a rational world. The Mike Malloy Show, only on Nova M Radio.
It's evil out there, man. That state is always on fire. Everyone has a system, but they can't seem to win. Even Bob Geldof looks alarmingly thin.
21 past the hour.
Get on that shuttle, get me out of this place. But there's going to be warfare.
The I've got to mention the Obama thing. I really do. Just very quickly here. And the best way to do it is to share with you something James Risser wrote. And if you're familiar with his work, you're familiar with his work. He writes, "A journey through the past week has proven that America is not even close to being post-race, as some would have us believe. No, what this week has shown us is that white Americans may be able to get their collective head around the idea of voting for a black man. That while Americans may be able to get their collective head around the idea of voting for a black man, they will not do so if that black man has ever associated with an uppity Negro. It seemed for about an hour and a half Friday night that perhaps America's view of the most recent uppity Negro could be mollified by the smooth as silk dulcet voice of Bill Moyers. And the now dressed like a white man with his elbows on the table, Reverend, cooing softly to the nice white fellow with the tie. Ah, but alas, it was not to be. It was but a mirage. The NAACP speech was just too much, and absent Mr. Moyer's whiteness to protect us by petting the Reverend Wright softly and almost purring into his ear, our uppity Negro dared to, well, be uppity. And America may not be as bad as it was, but it just is not ready to listen to an uppity Negro. God forbid they challenge the Negro du jour with counter-arguments. To do so would be to legitimize him. Oh, and we white folks don't have convincing counters. What the man said in Detroit was solid as a rock. I leave aside one of our other favorite uppity Negroes, the good Reverend Sharpton, who we all knew could not endorse Senator Obama because once he did, the filthy knuckle-draggers at Fox and elsewhere would have Senator Obama roped together with the Reverend Sharpton so that they both would cast an indistinguishable shadow for the next several months. How truly pathetic it all is. By Sunday, Senator Obama was licking at the trough at Fox with his hat in hand, like a beggar selling pencils to passersby who could care less if he lived or died. Monday gave us the press club. Uh-oh! Uppity Negro, days away from the docile petting of Mr. Moyers, and days after the NAACP decided that the latter event was indeed more to his liking and told it as it is. Again, nothing he said was incorrect. But no one cared to argue against him. No, they don't have to, for he is an uppity Negro, and they need not apply. Today, Senator Obama, appearing in whiteface, a sandwich of bologna, Wonder Bread, and mayonnaise beside him for support, heaved one uppity Negro so far under the bus that he may have come out of the backside of it as exhaust. But no fear. The bus was ridden over his carcass, over and over. The faux liberals all breathed a sigh of relief. Woo! Glad that's over with. But it isn't over. It will not be over until the time that uppity Negroes are no more. And I've got news for America. It ain't going to happen. And this campaign, as it unfolds and winds its way through the streets of Denver, will, God willing, make the uppity Negro the rule and not the exception. Now, having said all that, and I think Risser is very right on with what he said, I don't find anything. If you take Jeremiah Wright completely out of context, set him over here, divorce him completely, let's pretend like Barack Obama never knew him. Everything that Jeremiah Wright has said has been in that style of talking that I find highly informative as well as entertaining. It gives me a look into the consciousness of African Americans, a look that white folks are not really allowed to have except only occasionally. It also... it is clearly evident that, to me anyway, that everything Jeremiah Wright has said has been, when he's addressed facts, has been correct. Okay, maybe the thing about Minister Farrakhan was not correct, at least not to white people, you see. But as has been pointed out by all the white commentators, Jeremiah Wright comes from a different generation, where this sort of thing was, this kind of rhetoric was, if not the foundation of the preaching in the black church, certainly had a starring role there. I can remember 30 years ago here in Atlanta going with friends, I've mentioned this before, over to Wheat Street Baptist Church and some of the churches over on near downtown Atlanta. Excuse me. And the reason we would go would be to hear the choirs in these churches on Sunday. The choirs were just astonishing. And it was sort of indicated to us that as guests of the church, we had to sit up in the balcony, which we found like, oh yeah, of course. And the preacher invariably, we'd stick around for the sermon, invariably, it would be something about the white folks and so on and so forth, and he would look up in the balcony where we were and make some sort of a wan gesture as though, well, not these white folks, because at least they showed up for services, but there's something else about Jeremiah Wright, though, that I want to say. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Look at the people. They got terror in their eyes. Madness is coming and can't be denied. They're running with the dogs and afraid to die. Changing the weather. Changing the weather.
Than a flying monkey, more powerful than a special prosecutor. It's Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio.
George W. Bush. I was going to say something else about Reverend Wright. Oh, I'm sorry. All right, what I was going to say about Reverend Wright is he is assassinating Barack Obama. Regardless of what his motivations are, regardless of the truth in what he says, except that Minister Farrakhan bit, he is murdering Barack Obama's, metaphorically speaking, he is murdering his chances to be president of the United States. And Barack Obama just, tried today to, as James Risser pointed out, to throw this uppity Negro under the bus. But it's simply not going to work. That's not the way it works in this country, and it certainly, damn sure, I've been told, doesn't work that way in the black community. So, what to do? This, of course, is absolute, pure serendipity, of course, but just absolute a miracle for both Hillary Clinton and John McCain that somebody like Jeremiah Wright showed up and started doing what he's doing. Now, as Bob Herbert pointed out in his column today in the New York Times, Mr. Wright has discovered that he has his 15 minutes now, and he's going to use it. This is celebrity-driven America. So if you can get interviewed by Bill Moyers and address the NAACP and go in front of the National Press Club and be talked about for weeks and weeks on every single channel over the air and cable, it becomes sort of like doing really, really good heroin. And I think Jeremiah Wright is now a full-blown absolute addict. I wish his 15 minutes would end, but I don't think they're going to, because there's also some addicts involved here, and that is American television media medium. They love this kind of stuff. It's perfect. They don't dare talk about issues, but they will talk about the Reverend Wright. But again, what Jeremiah Wright has done and is in the process of doing is murdering the political campaign of Barack Obama.
Well, I also have to take just a slight issue, because I've been sick and I've been forced to watch more television more than I even usually watch, which is a lot. And I think I saw more of Reverend Wright excerpts than you did. I watched most of his NAACP speech and a lot of his presser on Monday. And I'm telling you, I don't know if I can agree with, oh, well, everything he says is true. It's just so much of it is misconstrued and yada, yada. Because I'm telling you, I don't know what democratic principle is served by his mocking the speech patterns of John F. Kennedy. I'm not sure the point about, well, black children are criticized for their speech, but tell me what ERSC means. ERSC, what you can do for your country. ERSC, what's ERSC? I don't see how that's furthering any kind of polite discourse on the subject of racial equality.
But Reverend Jeremiah Wright is not in this for polite discourse on racial equality.
No, I think he's in there, like you said, and like Bob Herbert made the point, to jump around in front of the camera now. I mean, why he had to bring a literal Greek chorus of his congregation to a press conference to go, that's right, amen, hallelujah, where he could hold up his ear waiting for a call and response. When Jesus said blank, I said blank. I mean, it was ridiculous. Ridiculous! Right. That's not a press conference. That was some kind
of a performance,
theatrical event. Sure. That of course, got a lot of media attention. It's not going to do anything except cause, like I said, cause Barack Obama to drop his, you know, pancakes or a bottle in the middle of Missy's House of Muffins in Terre Haute. It's an embarrassment, and I don't know what Barack Obama could do other than just continue to distance himself and say, people, I'm trying to talk about issues. How many times do I have to say I want nothing more to do with this clown?
But that's not going to happen because television... television, if it's a vampire, this is a couple of jugular veins just lying there waiting for the fangs. Barack Obama and Jeremiah Wright. This is what the vampiric media, television medium in this country does. What it does. It just sucks the life force out of everything. So it's not over. And again, that's why I say, while I don't see anything that Jeremiah Wright has said to be, excuse me, factually incorrect. Some of it is opinion, obviously, probably most of it. But I'm white. Jeremiah is Wright is black. He's talking from the black experience, the same way I talk from the white experience. So even the Minister Farrakhan statement is something that you and I, Kathy, because we're Caucasians, may not be able to understand what the man is saying. In the context of the black experience in this country, Minister Farrakhan and his statements has been one of the most profound individuals in the 20th and as Wright said, 21st century. But the point is, regardless of the correctness of what Wright is saying, he is assassinating this political campaign.
Well, drawing a comparison between the AIDS epidemic in America and the Tuskegee experiment and saying he wouldn't put it past the American government.
I've said that.
Over the edge.
But I've said that. I've said it from the standpoint of if white people don't understand why. I'm not saying it's correct, but if white people don't understand why that suspicion lurks, it's because white people just don't get it. When you have a decades-long experiment like the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, where black people were left to die so that the results of their dying could be incorporated into a treatment manual or something, and they weren't told about it, then why is it so hard for white people to understand that black folk may say, well, if they did, it's like I say every night, Kathy, George Bush lied us into a war, he'll lie about everything.
But the Reverend Wright wasn't saying, I can understand why black people believe this.
He doesn't
have to. He
was saying,
I can understand how this is
possible.
Well,
he's black. Well, he's a black man.
Well, there's a difference. And you're not endorsing, you know, you're not the personal counselor to a presidential candidate either. I think that he is murdering Obama's chance. And I don't understand why he's doing it unless he's just secretly PO'd because Obama didn't.
Right.
You know, didn't cuddle up to him.
Obama did cuddle up to him, and he said he could no more toss Reverend Wright off the bus than his own white grandmother. There's something else going on, and I think it's the celebrityness that is so prevalent in the society. If you're not on television, you don't exist. If you don't have your 15 minutes with everybody gathering around you to hear what you've got to say, you become absolutely, utterly superfluous. And I don't think Reverend Wright wanted that to happen. But again, I have no problem with understanding why black America, as off base as it is, why black America, certain elements of black America, and I'm not saying that condescendingly, would say, look, if they did it to us at Tuskegee, why wouldn't they do it to us at Fort Detrick and develop some sort of a bio agent and then release it into black community? Now, aside from the fact that the first cases in America turned up among white homosexual males, aside from the fact that all indications are that the AIDS virus was sitting in a population of primates in Africa for probably hundreds of years before it made the jump into the human species. Aside from all that, I'm not arguing science here. I'm saying if you have been abused to the extent that black folk were in the Tuskegee Institute, why not?
And all I'm saying is, why come out with all this stuff now when Obama is facing two crucial primaries? Why do you need to make four well-publicized media events in 4 days, bringing your little Greek chorus out there and talking about Farrakhan and AIDS and any of this to begin with if it's not, like you said, to grab the spotlight? But also, I mean, is the timing, did he just think, well, his window of opportunity would disappear to get up and jump around in front of the cameras? I mean, that's the part that really bothers me, is the timing of this. If he wants to say, you know, all the stuff he wants to say, as righteous or as crazy as it might be, depending on your perspective, fine. Does he have to do it now?
Okay. All right. Well, I can understand. I mean, I don't get me wrong. I feel the same frustration you do. I really do. I'm not trying to be argumentative about this. I think this guy is really doing something that I don't understand the motivation for it. I just simply don't. I don't know what is pushing Reverend Wright, other than this lust for attention. I don't know what is pushing him to do this, but I didn't even want to get into that topic because it's sickening to me. This whole, and it's not so sickening, the interaction between Wright and Obama. What is sickening to me is the way media or television continues to beat this dead animal. Just beat it and beat it and beat it. And the sons of bitches will do it again tomorrow. I mean, this is not going to stop. This is the issue for American television during this election campaign. They have lashed this racism corpse to Obama, and they're not going to untie it and let this campaign continue. American media are not. Well, specifically television. They're not going to do it. They're not going to do it. So get used to this. This is the way it's going to be. And this is the part that I hate. It's me. It's television. It's not so much Wright or Obama. This could have been a very clear ho-hum moment were it not for the fact that some operative within the Republican Party or the Clinton campaign dug up the video and posted it on YouTube. Whoops, off to the races we go. So, can we do the Bush stuff now? how much time do we have in this segment? None? Okay. All right, well, we'll do it. We'll start it when we come back here then, because we have a handful of these, and I want you to hear these. And especially, about halfway into this, we're going to play for you the back and forth that occurred between ABC's Martha Raddatz. Was it ABC? Yeah, ABC's Martha Raddatz and this fake president we have. It was quite a little back and forth. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
Footsteps echo down the hall. No one's there at all. Dial your numbers on your voices. Everything is inside out. I don't know what it's about. You keep getting stranger by the day. Yeah. Stranger by the day. Yeah. You keep getting stranger by the day. Stranger by the day.
Ready for Radical Talk Radio? Make mine Mike Malloy on Nova M.
It's about 8 before the hour. There's some more economic reports due this week that are going to show further destruction by the Bush crime family to this limping economy and the job market. Knowing that, Bush got out there today and said that the country is going through hard times. But now, wait a minute. That's too passive. Why not say, look, everything that I have done since September 11, 2001 to crush this country is resulting in what is occurring now. So I take full responsibility. By the way, I'm just right now declaring martial law. It's And he also, he tries to put pressure on the Democratic Congress to pass his economic proposals, which would do nothing, absolutely nothing, except continue to give the elite top one half of 1% in this country everything. Everything. Remember, they don't want 80% of everything or 90% or 96%. The sons of bitches want everything. And that's what Bush, that's what Bush is there for. But anyway, at this Rose Garden News conference today, he was asked if he was concerned that the reports coming out, well, tomorrow on the gross domestic product might indicate that we're in a recession. Bush said, I think they'll show that we're in a very slow economy. This guy is so separated from reality as to render everything he says or does just a vaudeville act. But here it is. Let's start with this one. Bush opened his press conference by blaming Congress for not fixing the economy that he ruined.
It's a tough time for our economy. Across our country, many Americans are understandably anxious about issues affecting their pocketbook.
Really?
From gas and food prices to mortgage and tuition bills. They're looking to their elected leaders in Congress for action.
They're not looking to you.
Unfortunately, on many of these issues, all they're getting is delay.
Or lies.
Americans are concerned about energy prices. I'm not going to understand why. last time I visited with you, it was like a tax increase on the working people.
Oh, really? You said that? Yeah.
Past 18 months. Gas prices have gone up by $1.40 per gallon.
Tell King Saud to open the spigots.
Electricity prices for small business and families are rising as well.
No!
I've repeatedly submitted proposals to help address these problems. Yet time after time, Congress chose to block them.
Yeah, you know, drilling and opening up more refineries. As a matter of fact, he gets refineries. Well, the reason we got a problem here is refinery. We haven't built a refinery. The refineries are only running at 85% capacity. The oil companies don't want any more. They just made a first quarter $14 billion profit. Why, Mr. Dumbass Bush, would they want more refineries? That's called cash outflow. Oh, my God. But yeah, Bush has got all the solutions, and that damn Congress, those dirty, rotten, stinky Democrats that have such a big majority in the House and the Senate, they get everything done that they want done, and there's nothing I can do. They have emasculated me. They have taken my pants down and just sliced and diced me. There's nothing I can do. I keep asking them. I don't know who to turn to. But, you know, Democrats in Congress just want to see the entire middle class slide down the crapper. And here I am trying to save everybody and fight two wars. I didn't want to be a war president. You know, I really didn't. But it was thrust on me by events that I engineered. That filthy Congress, keeping Americans from enjoying affordable groceries while making farmers millionaires. That's right. Congress is creating legions of uber-rich farmers. Haven't you heard? It's not the corporate CEOs or oil barons who hold the nation's wealth. It's the farmers, and it's all Congress's fault.
Americans are concerned about rising food prices. Unfortunately, Congress is considering a massive, bloated farm bill that would do little to solve the problem. The bill Congress is now considering failed to eliminate subsidy payments to multimillionaire farmers.
It's them!
Congress can reform our farm programs, and should. America's farm economy is thriving.
Yeah!
The value of farmland is skyrocketing. And
yeah!
This is the right time to reform our nation's farm policies by reducing unnecessary subsidies.
Let's go for it.
It's not the time to ask American families who are already paying more in the checkout line to pay more in subsidies for wealthy farmers.
Those goddamn farmers. Those dirty, rotten, crappy farmers. I hate you, farmers. The value of farmland is skyrocketing. Yeah, that's because of your half-witted energy policies. You see, they're planting more corn to convert to ethanol, so we're going to starve certain parts of the rest of the world, you know, colored parts of the world that are third world anyway. You know, just let them starve.
When's the last time you've met or heard of a multi-millionaire farmer? The rich farmers are the reason that it costs $4 to buy a banana?
Ted Turner. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio. Stay with us. Malloy here on the Nova M Radio Network. Let's continue with some of the comments from Chuckle Nuts from his presser today, where he's explaining about how this wonderful, amazing economy that went south, about 3 days after he took office. And, of course, none of it's his fault. No. This is a holdover from the Clinton recession. Not his fault. No. It's that dirty, rotten Democratic Congress that just... No. It's because of wealthy farmers. No. It's because he's a war president and he hit the trifecta and it's never George Bush's fault. Nothing. And the worst thing about Congress is that it wants to see more Americans homeless. You see, Congress is doing all it can to make sure average Americans lose their homes to foreclosure. That's right. Bushonomics had nothing to do with it, and all of his rip-off buddies on Wall Street and the hedge funds and the dirty, lying sons of bitches that have gutted the capital system in this country. Not that it didn't need gutting. And now they want to do away with the SEC. Too much regulation, you see. Bush had nothing to do with any of this. The failure to regulate mortgage lenders, not issued all, the big banks who backed Bush had no hand in this whatsoever. It's that dirty, rotten, filthy Congress that's hell-bent on ruining America, raising gas prices, starving the citizens, forcing them out of their homes, molesting the children. Maybe it's an evil plot to allow all those wealthy farmers to move in. Take over!
Americans are concerned about making their mortgage payments.
And
keeping their homes. And I don't blame them.
Oh, really?
Last year I called on Congress to pass legislation that would help address problems in the housing market.
They ignored me.
This includes critical legislation that would modernize the Federal Housing Administration, reform Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
You know those ghetto...
And allow crackers? State housing agencies to issue tax-free bonds to refinance subprime loans.
Oh, really?
Yet they failed to send a single one of these proposals to my desk.
Bastards.
Americans should not have to wait any longer for their elected officials to pass legislation to help more families stay in their homes.
Hey, Chuckle Nuts, the Democrats in Congress opposed that plan because it had no real muscle, no enforcement measures, bank compliance was voluntary, nobody had to do anything, you weasel. It would have made it easier for the theft to go on. The mortgage industry wants Congress to pass this weak piece of crap bill so it won't pass a tougher law. That might rewrite the bankruptcy laws. The way he tosses off Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, you know he thinks these are ghetto nicknames of gang members or something. Yeah, we're Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. And now that his opening empty attack on Congress is out of the way, Bunny Pants turned to questions from the press. Was I the only one that half expected Reverend Jumpin' Jeremiah Wright to leap out of the bushes and grab the mic? But I digress. This reporter says, Mr. Bush, you have said that we need to wait until the first stimulus has taken effect to act again. But since it was passed, gas prices have gone up, foreclosures have gone up, There have been more layoffs. News just this morning that consumer confidence is at the lowest it's been in what? Half a century? Isn't it time to think about doing more?
I will tell you this.
Oh, okay.
That if Congress is truly interested in solving the problem, they can send the right signal by saying we're going to explore for oil and gas in the U.S. territories, starting with ANWR. We can do so in an environmentally friendly way.
Alaska is a state now.
They ought to say, you know, why don't we, I propose, you might remember, taking some abandoned military bases and providing regulatory relief so we can build new refineries.
What?
I mean, if we're generally interested in moving forward with an energy policy that sends a signal to the world that we're going to try to become less reliant upon foreign oil, we can explore at home.
Yeah. I don't know. How about downtown Houston? Explore. They can send the right signal, Congress can, by saying we're going to explore for oil and gas in the U.S. territories, starting with ANWR. Raisin Brain, it's not a territory. Really, it isn't. And you can do so in an environmental-friendly way. That's what he said, environmental-friendly way. Really? How do we do that? You can't have ice roads up there anymore because, guess what, dumbass, there's no more ice. So Bush just can't make his Weasley lips form the word recession. Even when it's virtually rubber stamped across the top of every newspaper around the country, 80% of Americans say we're there. Most of Europe says, poor America, poor America. This reporter says, Mr. President, were you premature in saying that the U.S. economy is not in a recession? When food and energy prices are so high, and what more can you do to persuade Saudi Arabia during your upcoming visit to reconsider output levels and cut prices? Let me tell you something. If King Saud wants to do more than just hold hands and kiss, would you go to third base with him for cheaper oil? Let me ask you this, George. Are you willing to go all the way with the king? Huh?
You know, the words on how to define the economy don't reflect the anxiety the American people feel.
Sure, sure.
You know, the average person doesn't really care what we call it. The average person wants to know whether or not we know that they're paying higher gasoline prices and that they're worried about staying in their homes. And I do understand that. These are tough times.
Say the word.
Economists can argue over the terminology.
Say recession.
These are difficult times.
Recession.
And so, and to your question on the Saudis, look, I have made the case that, you know, the high price of oil injures economies.
And they gave me the finger.
But I think we better understand that there's not a lot of excess capacity in this world right now.
Yeah, you got that right.
I think an important signal to send on energy, just like I said, is to say, okay, we're going to go find oil here at home.
Yeah, yeah, we're going to find it. Is there some over there? Look behind that bush. Is there some over there? No, no, none over there. You know, because the Saudis sure aren't going to give us any more, no matter how much I kiss that king or squeeze his hand. They said it was my failed economic policies that got us into this mess, so tough luck. Say recession, chuckle nuts. If you don't, we're all going to laugh at you. If you'll say it, I'll have Reverend Wright jump out from behind that tree and give you a cookie. Just say it. Say recession. Say it. Say it. Go ahead. Just one time, you weaselly little bastard, admit that you are a total screw-up. Just once. No man or monkey presser is complete without the phrase switchgrass. So here goes. Is Bush back on the blow? Is it Jenna's impending wedding that has him so jittery? What's up with the increased stammer? Listen to this. Dana Perino sharing her special blend with him before pressers? Huh? Here, Mr. President, try some of this. Oh, damn! Oh, Dana, where'd you get that? In the valley. This reporter says, you just said there's not a lot of excess supply out there. Some energy experts think we may have already passed or be within a couple of years of passing the maximum oil pumping capability. In other words, we may be close to tapping all we got. Do you think that's the case? Or if you do, why haven't you put more resources into renewable energy research?
Matter of fact, the solution to the issue of corn-fed ethanol is cellulosic ethanol, which is a fancy word for saying we're going to make ethanol out of switchgrasses.
Yeah, switchgrasses.
And so you say that the people think we can't. There's not any more reserves to be found. Well, there are reserves to be found in Anwar.
Yeah,
that's a given.
Yeah.
And not only that, we can explore in environmentally friendly ways. New technologies enables for to be able to drill like we've never been able to do so before.
Ah, yeah. You want to drill like never before. That's a great answer. I want to drill like I've never before drilled. Let's drill. Give me some drill. I want some drill. Where's that Saudi king? Him and me get together. We'll drill. In a manner of speaking.
We can build roads of ice that literally melt away when summer comes.
Not anymore, chuckle nuts. All right, here we go. Just when Shrub thought he was going to get by with a jokey, folksy, kind of easy press conference, you know, kicking ass and talking about them switchgrasses and stuff like that, the late Martha Raddatz threw him a curveball instead of a softball with a question about deteriorating conditions in Afghanistan. You see there, Martha, Bush the Lesser will just cut off your mic if he isn't in the mood to talk about a topic more serious than switchgrass and how Congress is trying to starve working-class Americans. The late Martha Raddatz said, thank you, Mr. President. I'd like to switch to Afghanistan. There was another attempt on President Karzai's life. There are operations going on there right now. Is the strategy succeeding? Are we winning in Afghanistan?
I think we're making progress in Afghanistan, but there's a very resilient enemy that obviously wants to kill people that stand in the way of their reimposition of a state that is, which vision is incredibly dark. I mean, but I'm pleased with a lot of things. One, I'm pleased with the number of roads that have been built. I'm pleased with the number of schools that have opened up. I'm pleased a lot of girls, young girls are going to school. I'm pleased health clinics are now being distributed around the country. I'm pleased with the Afghan army that when they're in the fight, they're good. I wish we had completely eliminated the radicals who kill innocent people to achieve objectives, but that hadn't happened yet. So I think it's very much in our interest to continue helping the young democracy. And we will, yeah.
So
obviously, we've got a follow-up.
Do you think we're winning?
I do. I think we're making good progress. I do.
Yeah. Can I just add to that a couple of weeks
No, you can't.
Ago.
This is the second follow-up. You usually get one follow-up. It's nice enough to give you one. I didn't give anybody on this side a follow-up, and now you are trying to take a second follow-up. I know you try. Yeah. Now they just cut off your mic. You can't. No. Now she's going to go without the mic. This is awesome.
You said that in Iraq in 2006, you said we were winning and the strategy was working to keep up troop morale. How can we believe that you're not doing the same thing
here? Are you trying to ask me that question before or is it a repeat? Look, I said, but can I finish, please? The question you asked me before at the exclusive I gave you on the ranch was, you said that we were winning in the past. I also said that there was tough fighting. Make sure you put the comments in place. So what I'm going to tell you now is we're making progress in Afghanistan, but there's tough fighting. I'm under no illusions that this isn't tough. I know full well we're dealing with a determined enemy. I believe it's in our interest that we defeat that enemy. And so, yeah, we're making progress.
Yeah.
But it's also a tough battle. We're facing people who are willing to strap bombs on themselves and walk into places where the innocent, you know, dwell, or the innocent shop, and kill them.
Like Timothy McVeigh.
And the notion that somehow we can let these people just kind of have their way, or, you know, let's don't stir them up, is naive or disingenuous, and it's not in our nation's interest. We are in a global struggle against thugs and killers.
And that's just Blackwater.
And the United States of America has got to continue to take the lead. And so in Afghanistan, yeah, we're making progress. Does that mean, you know, that we're, you know, it's over? No, it doesn't mean it's over. We're in a long struggle, as I've told you many a time, against these jihadists.
Jesus Christ. Oh, where's the ice pick? Oh, here it is. Here's the ice pick. Okay. That was George Bush and the late Martha Raddatz. Immediately after they cut off her mic, they also cut off her water, and then they cut off her food. And last we heard, Martha was in a truck heading somewhere, in the back of the truck, the part that's covered over with canvas. They cut her goddamn mic off! The White House press person who is in charge of the microphones cut off her mic. Good for Martha Raddatz. Good for Martha Raddatz. One of the few journalists left, along with Helen Thomas, in that crack White House press corps that has any concept of why they're there. They're not there so they can wear the badge, the White House press corps badge, when they go out for a drink after work and people come up and marvel. That's not why they're there. They're there to ask the kinds of questions that Martha Raddatz does, and when this fake-ass president tells her to sit down and shut up, she does not sit down, and she does not shut up. She keeps asking her question. Yeah, they cut off your mic and you're still talking. That's so funny. That's so funny. Sit down, bitch. I mean, sit down. You had 2-3 follow-ups. You know, sit down. Did I say bitch? I didn't mean bitch. I don't mean that. And Martha Raddatz just keeps going. Like the Energizer Bunny. And the rest of the crack White House press corps just sits there and kind of like, oh Christ, now what do we do? Does that mean we have to ask real questions too? Oh, no.
Logical and more commonsensical than to understand our hemisphere.
It's about 25 before the hour. Are we finished with this? No? All right. Just a couple more here. Now, speaking of magical fantasy thinking, the ice roads and all that other stuff, another reporter tried to get Mensa Man to say the R word. And the late Martha Raddatz's last question threw him so much that all he can do is stammer about magic wands. He blames Congress again, and he forgets what century we're in. Mr. President, you've spoken today about opening ANWR for drilling and also refineries, but these are clearly long-term solutions to the problem of rising gas prices. What can you tell Americans about what your administration is doing in the short term? And secondly, have you been briefed on tomorrow's GDP numbers? And, you know, are you concerned that they will show us to officially be in a recession?
I think they'll show that it's a very slow economy. I can't guess what the number would be, and I haven't been shown, truly.
Say recession!
And by the way, opening up ANWR is not long-term. It's intermediate term.
Oh.
But it sends a clear signal, is what it does. It sends a signal to the markets that the United States is not going to restrict exploration. The United States is going to encourage exploration.
The markets want to
and
know
so,
that.
And so I firmly believe that, you know, if there was a magic wand to wave, I'd be waving it, of course. It's, you know, I strongly believe it's in our interest that we reduce gas prices, gasoline prices. It means it'd be like a major tax cut for people.
Really?
No, I think that if there was a magic wand, I'd say, okay, drop price.
Woo!
I'd do that.
Woo!
But there is no magic wand to wave right now. It took us a while to get to this fix. That's why I told you that if Congress had responded, matter of fact, Congress did pass ANWR in the late 1900s, 1990s. And the 1990s. But it didn't go forward.
What century is it now? Quick, ask Cheney. If I had a magic wand, I would say, moron, go home. I'd do. That's what I would do. If I had a magic wand, drop price.
Thud.
Hi, I'm the President of the United States. And I said in 63 seconds, magic wand, three times. Three times I said magic wand. Of course, it's my policies that have absolutely gutted, destroyed, and ripped this country to pieces. There's no magic wand to wave right now. It took us a while to get to this fix. Yeah. 7 years. And what? That's why I told you that if Congress had responded, matter of fact, Congress did pass ANWR in the late 1900s, 1980, 1917, 1912, but it didn't go forward. Well, if it didn't go forward and Congress did pass it, then why are you talking about Congress? Oh, never mind. That's not long term. That's intermediate term. 15 years. Who told you it'd be 20? It's only 15. Jesus God. Last one. I'm sorry. Still on Bush's speech problem. Why he's having such a hard time pronouncing the R word. This reporter says, on to the subject of the day, Mr. President. I talked to James Clyburn before this press conference, and he said, as a man thinketh, so are we. And Americans believe we're in a recession. What will it take for you to say those words? We are in a recession. If I give you a new Game Boy or cheeseburger, maybe?
I've answered the question on the words and terminologies. I will tell you that these are very difficult economic times.
Say it!
Very difficult. And we'll let the economists define it for what it is.
Say it!
I would hope that that those who worry about recession,
yes!
slowdown, whatever you want to call it,
yes!
make the tax cuts permanent as a way of helping to address this issue.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Because if you're somebody out there trying to plan your future and you're worried about the future, it's going to cause different behavioral patterns.
What? What? Make the tax cuts permanent as a way of helping to address this issue. You're crazy. You're just crazy. Because if you're somebody out there trying to plan your future and you're worried about the future, it's going to cause different behavioral patterns. It might cause people to vote for Democrats. you know, because they're losing their homes. They're paying $70 to fill up their cars, and they can't buy rice, and a banana costs $3. It might cause different behavior patterns. What do you mean? Does that mean that instead of walking on green, you walk on red? And when it says don't walk, you run? The psychologist in chief. There he is. Thank you very much. It's like a goddamn Daily Show segment. Unbelievable stuff. I've just got to toss this in. You can toss it right back out if you like, and then we'll go to your phone calls. This is from Longview, Washington. This is from the Daily News Online. Longview, Washington, I believe. Longshoremen should finish unloading 6,700 tons of sand contaminated with depleted uranium and lead this afternoon, said Chad Hyslop, spokesman for the disposal company American Ecology. Ship arrived at the port Saturday afternoon with the 306 containers carrying the contaminated sand from Camp Doha, a U.S. Army base in Kuwait. The sand was packaged in bags designed to transport hazardous waste. Longshoremen unloaded the containers in two shifts Sunday and two more Monday. They wore standard safety gear, and dust protection equipment and respirators were available, according to Mr. Hyslop. However, no one has opted to wear the respirators, he said. No one wanted to wear them. It's gone real smooth, Mr. Hyslop said, Chad said. Half the containers will be loaded onto 76 rail cars and transported to an American Ecology disposal site in Idaho. The other half will remain at the port until the train returns to haul them to Idaho. The containers all will be at the disposal site in Idaho for 15 to 30 days, Mr. Hyslop said. State Department of Health personnel are at the port in Longview, Washington, to test radiation levels and to ensure none of the sand spills. The sand became contaminated with low levels of depleted uranium following a fire at Camp Doha during the first Gulf War in 1991, according to Mr. Hyslop and Army sources. The Army then discovered potentially hazardous levels of lead in the shipment. Hyslop said he's been happy with the job the port and other government agencies have done in helping with the transport of the material. He said, quote, "We're extremely pleased and impressed with the outstanding professionalism of the Port of Longview," end quote. So it was so hazardous they had to get it out of Kuwait, and they're moving it to Idaho. 6,700 tons of sand contaminated with lead and depleted uranium. Okay. So that means within 240,000 years, that contamination will have reduced to practically nothing. Sherwin is calling from Seattle. Sherwin, welcome to the program. Hi.
Hi, I'm still hanging in here.
Yeah, you're on the air now, Sherwin. This is Mike.
Oh, yeah. Mike, you're real funny, man.
Yeah?
I've been cracking up here.
Oh, good.
What I wanted to say is, you know, I don't think that the media is giving white America enough credit. I think that this black-white thing that they're trying to sell is only generating a lot of talk in the media. Yeah. I think people have a lot more sense, and they can see through, you know, what the media is trying to do. I just think that people want a change in America. And if you elect Hillary Clinton, you're going to get the status quo. If you elect McCain, it's the same. But with Barack Obama, you got change. America will have to answer a lot of questions. They will have to confront a lot of issues that they haven't confronted in the past in a different way with a new perspective. It'll bring a new light on a lot of things in America.
Well, Sherwin, I hope you're right. I hope you're right. That's a pretty optimistic point of view. Thanks, Sherwin. I appreciate it. Take care, pal. Thanks to the crew. Ian Huff, who engineered the program, also answered your calls. Billy Foster, our technical director. Ben Birch, the podcast manager. Kristen Minnesota is our senior correspondent. Bob Alexander, our resident philosopher. Bridget Wolf, our writer in residence. And Sharon Gordy is our military affairs correspondent. Thanks to everybody. Catherine Bay is the executive producer of this program. And no, this is just allergies you hear. Kathy is sick. LaShonda is calling from Austin, Texas, listening on the internet. LaShonda, welcome to the program.
What's going on tonight, Mike?
Oh, man. If it got any funkier in here, I would feel like I was in Pee-wee's Playhouse. I can't take this anymore.
Man, you had somebody that talked about the tipping point last night that people are getting to. I don't know. Today's press conference kind of pushed me over the edge with Bush.
I hear that.
Man, this fool, he begged so much, his damn hands look like cups.
That's the truth.
All the time, and he never wants to take the blame for nothing. See,
nothing,
I blame
nothing.
I blame his mama. I blame his mom and his daddy because they should have whooped his ass when he was little and made him take responsibility.
That's right. They should have just, I don't know. I think Jeb got whooped. I think the other two got whooped, and the daughter, well, you know what happened to her, but George never got whipped. And you're right. They should have taken him out, got a willow branch, and just beat his ass.
I mean, and it's so crazy. And he's talking about, I understand how people are feeling. I'm not tripping about the gas. I'm worried about filling up my stomach, my husband's stomach, my child's stomach. You talking about $4 for some broccoli. $4 for some broccoli, man. It's bad when I have been reduced to eating bologna sandwiches for lunch.
I'm sorry.
Bologna and cheese, like I'm in jail.
Oh, no. On white bread?
I do scrape up some money and get some good wheat bread.
Okay.
Mike, my God, one day me and you and Kathy, we're going to have to sit down and drink us some super beans with a shot of Jack Daniels.
We're gonna have to do that. We're going to have to do that repeatedly and over and over again.
Oh, my goodness. I don't have anything potent or profound to say. I'm speechless. And
I know.
If I still smoke weed, I'd be causing weed man right now.
I hear you.
Oh, Jesus. Okay. You have a good night, Mike, Kathy. And I will talk to y'all later.
Thanks, LaShonda. Keep your chin up.
I will. Bye-bye.
All right. Goodbye. Sometimes you have to call the radio talk show man just to say, I don't have anything to say. But Teresa, who is sitting on the dock of the bay waiting for the next tide of hell to roll in Spring, Texas, Teresa writes, Mike, thank goodness for Reverend Wright's candidness. Had he been one of the old black bootlicking preachers, his sermons would not have been an issue for in Obama's chances of becoming the president, and Obama's chances of becoming president would be greater, which is not what I want for him. America is in the beginning phase of a great calamity. And the first black U.S. president would certainly be the perfect whipping boy for white folk. Roll on, Reverend Wright. See, that's what I'm talking about, Kathy. This is what, you know, this is what, I completely agree with you that he is murdering Obama's chances to be president. But, yeah, he's grabbing the spotlight and he's tripping all over the country. I mean, this man came out of retirement in order to put on this show. But who's he putting the show on for? Is he doing it for black folk? Is he doing it for white folk? You know, who's he putting the show on for? But I agree with Teresa. Roll on, Reverend Wright. Roll on. Wanda is calling from Dallas, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Wanda.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm all right. How about you?
I'm okay, I guess.
Uh-oh.
Listen, I just wanted to kind of throw a sobering moment in here. You are hilarious sometimes. I just died laughing listening to you sometimes.
Well, I'm glad. That's a great tension reliever because you know we're all about to go crazy. So
it is. We are all pulling our hair out.
I hear you.
But let me just speak to this Reverend Wright and the AIDS issue.
Okay.
Let me tell you how some of us black Americans make not a leap to that, but like a slow progression.
Can you do it in a minute and a half?
I'm going to try to wrap it up in a minute and a half.
All right, go ahead.
Bear with me.
Go ahead.
In 1974, I had went to Planned Parenthood to have a pregnancy test done.
Mm-hmm.
They canceled me, asked me if I would be open to abortion, to adoption. Of course, I said no. Well, they came back and told me I wasn't pregnant, but yet gave me these pills that were supposed to make my period come on.
Uh-huh.
Within 3 days, I had a miscarriage. My father took me to the hospital only to find out that I was actually 4 months pregnant. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
A year and a half later, I had a son that wound up dying six weeks after he was born
of what
was called at the time crib death. In my community, in my circle of friends, 5 of my friends' babies also died within a 6-week period. One of those girls had twins whose babies died 2 weeks apart.
All of them
were said to have been crib death.
Mm.
If you go back to the 1970s, you will find that there were record infant fatality deaths in the black neighborhood. And most of us believe that something was being done to our children.
I hear you.
And Dick Gregory has spoken to that within the past few weeks on the Mark Thompson show, saying that Planned Parenthood, which was a government-funded, totally funded agency at that period, was put into our neighborhoods to stop our growth.
Well, see, that
the population boom.
That's what I'm talking about, Wanda, and we're flat out of time. That's what I'm talking about. There is so much of this, and this is one thing that white people just can't get. They look at these statements by Wright where it concerns AIDS, and they say the man's crazy. Is he? Thanks for participating, y'all. I'll see you tomorrow night. Okay, take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio.